The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Wendy Clark. Wendy is the CEO of DDB North America, where she joined in 2016 after working at Coca-Cola North America, where she led the sparkling category business unit, as well as the strategic marketing organization, including brand strategy and innovation, media connections, investments and assets, content and design. Prior to that, Wendy was senior vice president of advertising for AT&T. She has received many accolades and honors, most recently being named the 2017 Executive of the Year by Ad Age. Wendy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Kelly. It's good to be with you.
You too. So one of the things that we talk about a lot in this podcast is why do people feel the need to check their humanity at the door when they enter their place of business? And often this is a reason because everyone else does it. But I found it really interesting when I was researching for this interview that your view of work-life balance seems to also resemble your POV when it comes to your approach when tending to brands. So in an interview, you said, quote, life balance is lip service, and you opt for a better term, which is, quote, life integration. And I think you're going to tell me you're offering a similar dyad when you say, quote, we have to meet every one of our clients where they are.
Yeah, well, yes, good research. It's interesting being quoted back to yourself. I think particularly as a woman, I have been told most of my career that I should choose to balance my family and my career. Mm-hmm. I have three young children, and I tend to think that's crap. When you think about trying to balance something like that, it's just it is an impossibility. I do think integration, though, mm-hmm. is entirely possible, and I think progressive employers allow you to integrate your life. And truthfully, all that then sort of ladders up to this notion that we have to be authentically who we are, right? If you run into me on the weekends at the grocery store, I am very hopeful that you'll see the same person that you might run into in the halls of DDB. And I don't want to be different people. I don't want to sort of check being a mom and check being a wife and a friend at the door when I walk through the doors at DDB. And one of the things we've worked very hard on in our culture is to really create an environment where people feel like they can bring their whole and full selves to work every day. Because at some point along the way, when they were interviewed by someone at DDB, we looked across the table and said, you know what, you, all of you, are the perfect fit into our organization. And we never want to just take part of someone. Like, oh, we'd like a little bit of you, but if you could keep these other things away. No, we looked across the desk and we said, all of you are going to make us even better. And so everything we strive for when we're building our culture, when we're talking about work-life integration, when we're talking about being our whole selves, is that this is an environment where every single bit of you is welcome and wanted.
And that gives you, I think, an incredible advantage both for your sort of personal life, but also for your work life, because everyone, and you talk about owning it, right? And I love this because it is a level of sort of responsibility that everyone needs to take for allowing people to own it, but also for you yourself saying, no, I'm going to give myself permission to own this. And you talk about sort of leaving, you know, when you have to leave your kids behind. I had the same thing at Second City. My kids are a little bit more grown now, but, you know, I would be on the road all the time. And instead of sort of making excuses for it and apologies, sort of letting them understand the experience and what's going on and then giving them your full presence when you are home. You can only do that if, quite frankly, you have a sense of happiness and contentment and purpose.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, I feel very fortunate to have had a career where I truly enjoy what I'm doing professionally. I don't tell this to people often, but, you know, half the time I probably do it for the fun of it and not the paycheck. Obviously, I want to live and prosper, but at the same time, yeah. I think you have to have that sort of litmus test where you love what you do so much that I'm definitely doing it for reasons well beyond the money. I think back to the thought, though, kind of bridging, I was thinking about some of the things we're doing that may be helpful for listeners to steal. I love stealing shamelessly good ideas from other people, so
sure.
I'll try to offer one. But one of the things we do at our organization every Monday, I broadcast to our 2,000 associates across North America. So we have 18 offices across the U.S. and Canada, and obviously I can't physically see them all the time that often, but one of the things we've committed to do is just do a live broadcast. So wherever I am in the world, at noon Eastern on Monday, I broadcast to our team just a very simple Zoom platform where, you know, I've been in a Delta Sky Club, I've been in any number of our offices, I've been on, you know, in Florida on vacation one Monday, but I still wanted to just be available for the team. And that's a forum where I speak openly and directly to the team about what's going on at the agency, but they also get to ask me questions in real time. So back to being that sort of transparent and open person, they literally send, you know, questions through on the chat, you know, column, and watch me read the question. I mean, there's no preparing for what someone will send you in real time. So I read the question as it comes across on the chat stream and answer it to the best of my ability. And I think that notion of these aren't polished or pat answers. These are answers from me earnestly in the moment. And some of them are very tricky. Some of them can be some difficult, like, you know, questions that they're asking about, you know, the future of the organization or a decision made on a particular client, or, you know, they're not necessarily, you know, lay up kind of, hey, just keep doing what you're doing type answers. So, I mean, I do think those sorts of things leaders can do and have to do now to be the type of leader that I think organizations are thriving for, which is open, honest, transparent, authentic, accessible every day, you know, and share your whole self. I mean, I'm asking them to bring their whole self to work. In the same regard, I've got to share my whole self with them.
And this feels connected to what your clients want, right? So we live in this social world where brands are interactive. They're communicating with their audiences. And if you don't do that authentically, if you're not available, I mean, look, you know, we're talking to you on April 13th, and what have we had? Pepsi, we've had United. There has been a series of corporate brand blunders, one after another, which seem to suggest that there is an inauthentic mode of communication going on.
Well, I think exactly. What brands have to do now is, you know, be open and transparent with consumers. I mean, I think the one thing that social networking has done, particularly with the rise of that, is we see each other all day long every day. I see what you eat for dinner. I see when you're with your friends. I know where you are in the world. I mean, I know so much about people that I really don't know, per se, that just builds an expectation on consumers' parts, on all of our parts, that we're going to have that level of knowledge and awareness of everything, right? We're going to feel that level of connectivity and dare I say, warmth, you know, feeling for brands in the same way. And so when you see brands take, you know, these missteps, which feel like they're so avoidable in some regard, and then not quickly move. So, I mean, I think in the case of United, you know, it's very clear when you have a brand misstep, what you've got to do. You have to immediately apologize.
Mm-hmm.
You then have to take full accountability, and then finally you have to commit to change. Right? It's not any more complex than that. So that immediate statement after that should have been, "This is a terrible thing that has happened." You know, as the head of this company, this rests with me, and I will not waste a minute in solving it, number one, and number two, committing to you that this will never happen again on any flight. Like, that's what the consumer wants to hear, to be like, okay, they get that this isn't acceptable. I think there's a wide acknowledgement that leadership can't be everywhere, that, you know, certainly the CEO is not going to be on every flight and understand that, but that the sense of culpability and accountability and the commitment to resolution and fixing it and making sure that never happens again, that's what every consumer wants to hear. And I think anything short of that really just kind of fans the flames of a continued dialogue that you probably don't want as a brand.
Yeah. You once said that advertising is, quote, an uninvited guest into people's lives. So this idea of seeing advertising as a party crasher, I thought was very compelling, because in that regard, like, if the party crasher comes in and is really entertaining, we're all kind of with it. But the minute if the party crasher comes in, like, breaks a vase, you're done. So,
well, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's a good, so that language I learned when I was at GSD&M, which is an agency in Austin. So, you know, almost 20 years ago in my career, but it was one of the things that we would say all the time. Remember, your starting point is that advertising is uninvited. So how do we get advertising and brands welcomed and invited? And you have to be respectful of, you know, of what consumers are doing. They're leading busy lives. They're, you know, I think you see brands sort of take this position of, you know, putting out a message, and essentially you could kind of wrap it up into them saying, you're welcome, you know? Mm-hmm. And that is not reflective of any consumer's life now, right? All of us can sit and think about our lives for a second and not be marketers and realize that, you know, with an average of 6,000 brand impressions every day for the average U.S. consumer, no one is looking for another message for another brand. There is no lack of content in the world. Mm-hmm. And so your content has to have some reason for being, right? It has to be useful, interesting, shareworthy, compelling. It has to have something. Otherwise, you're just on a heap of 6,000, and you really are going to just remain in that uninvited column.
Right. We talked to Simon Sinek not too long ago, who talks about, you know, starting with the why. What's the why? And you talk about the what, right? So what is this, you know, on behalf of the consumer? And you say, quote, you can't get to culture until you answer so what. And I think it's a very similar sentiment. I mean, what is the purpose? What's the meaning? You know, what does this mean for anyone else? And if you can't answer those questions, I imagine those advertising messages are never going to break through.
Well, that's right. Right. I mean, exactly. It's about creating something that has some value. There has to be a value exchange. Otherwise, you're just an interruption. And again, you're only waylaying me from either getting to the content that I want to get to, getting on with my life in a way, you know. And I think, interestingly, now that the technology is such, and I, you know, I'm not sure about you, but I can think of instances where brands and companies are very ham-fisted still. So. Mm-hmm. You know, just think about simple retargeting online. I went and bought a baby present for a friend's child who was having a baby. And now I'm getting retargeted with Babies R Us messages type. You know, and you kind of think, well, I'm not having a baby.
Thankfully.
I've done that. So, you know, those are the things where consumers have an expectation now that you're smarter than that. Mm-hmm. And we have to use all the technology and everything that's available to us to make sure, with all the data we have a lot of data, and there's a deep responsibility that comes with that, to use it really well and in respect of consumers' lives, to make their lives better, to have some sort of, you know, again, back to the so what. So how is this better for their life that message was out there and targeted to them?
Hmm. All right. I want to talk a little bit about your work past. I give a lot of keynotes, probably not as many as you do, but I always talk about the fact that my first gig out of college was as a dishwasher at Second City. Were you really a shift manager at McDonald's when you were 16?
I really was. It's one of my favorite stories. In fact, I mean, I am a huge McDonald's evangelist, and not just because they're a client. I was a huge McDonald's evangelist, you know, long before that. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked at McDonald's for about a year and a half when I was in high school, and I was ultimately a shift manager. And you think about what I was dealing with at 16, 17 years old. I was dealing with cash management. I was dealing with a shift of people. I was dealing with customer satisfaction, sometimes insubordination from employees. I mean, the skills that I learned early on in that role were significant for my age, 16, 17. And so I am a huge fan of the McDonald's experience. They give you an awful lot of responsibility if you want it, right? If you're striving and thriving, they're going to give you more and more opportunity and responsibility. And I find those work skills, I think, were really, really meaningful and powerful for me early in my life. So yeah. I'm a big advocate for McDonald's.
I felt the same way. I worked when I was 16. I was a bagger for a week at Jewel, and I got promoted to I was checking people out, And I really, it's formative, right? And for me, one of the most formative moments I had is I went into this massive place of business, and there's many Jewel grocery stores at that point across the Midwest. And I was like, this is barely controlled chaos, I kind of think. And I do think I was right. And sort of recognizing that not everyone has the answer or a plan. We're all kind of in this together. And you have a great quote just about, I think, your early work experience where you said, never be above doing anything. And that's so important.
I think it's, you know, I think you and I probably similarly get asked advice. I'm actually doing the commencement speech coming up at my alma mater at Florida State.
And, I did that a few years ago. It's the best.
Fun, right?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about, because one of the things they want you to say is impart advice. You know, what would you say to people coming out of college now? And of course, it's been 25 years for me. And one of the things that I say to young people always coming out of school is never be above doing anything. And my first job with a college degree in hand, I was a receptionist at an ad agency. Mm-hmm. Little did I know that 25 years later, I'd be the CEO at an ad agency. So one of the most, you know, compelling things I think I can say today is, look, from small seeds grow great oaks, and you can do anything with it, with the right work ethic and the right principle and, you know, again, obviously, the right education and all the things that we need to do to prepare. But you know, I was not, you know, I think it could have been easy back in the 1990-something, to say, well, I'm, you know, I want something different. I have my degree. You know, I don't want to be a receptionist. Well, it, you know, not being above doing that, getting in. And by the way, I put a perfectly skilled receptionist out of a job. It wasn't that I was skilled for that either. So I had my own set of learning to make sure I did that job well. But of course, it was formative and it was foundational and it was an entry into now an industry that I've never left and I love. And I do love being able to say that I've done, you know, the entry job all the way to the top job and everything in between. And I think that, you know, again, it's awfully helpful once you arrive to this seat.
Yeah. I mean, you know, far less dramatic mountains were climbed by myself. But, you know, having gone from the sort of dishwashing position and working seating the room at Second City and then working in the box office and then director of sales.
Exactly,
and then, you know, I mean, you know, at least there's a sort of an authentic way of like, I did that gig. I get it.
And yeah, and you've walked a mile in those shoes.
Yeah. And they feel it. There's another thing that you said in an interview. And I really connected to this because I think I mentioned this to you last time we spoke, maybe not, that we're working with the Center for Decision Research at Chicago Booth, and we're studying behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And one of the things, there's a hunch that we have and that the scientists have about this idea that creativity emerges out of discomfort. So one of the first sort of research projects we have is stretching across a bunch of our classes, and we're going to actually research this idea. And you said in the interview that you were talking about the creative approach to your work, and you said, I like to feel a little unsure.
Well, I do. The questions I get a lot around are, you know, why do you leave a certain job? Why did you leave Coke? It's got to be one of the best companies to work for. And I think part of it is I always want to be stretched and I always want to learn and grow. And yeah, I've been at Coke 7.5 years. I certainly didn't know everything about Coke after 7.5 years, but mm-hmm. I did feel like when I got approached for this job at DDB, I was like, wow, that would really stretch me. I've never run an agency before. I mean, you know, obviously a whole set of new skills and capabilities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do, you know, my metaphor is I like the water just below my nose. Like, so I have to paddle really hard to keep my nose out. But, you know, that I like that feeling of leaning into something, learning new skills, stretching, growing. I never want to be stagnant in my growth and my learning. It's really important to me to always sort of put myself deliberately in situations where I know I'm going to learn and grow.
So I know people always talk about like, well, people are just naturals. And the more I look at the research and the more I look at my own experience, I don't think that's the case. I think at some point along, you practiced that. And whether that came from your family or your peers or the situations you were put in, you had to have had experience all along the way of practicing being okay, being uncomfortable, because it's not the norm for most people.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, my childhood is fairly interesting. I my father's British, my mom's American. I was born in England. We moved here when I was about 12, and I went to from fifth grade to ninth grade, I went to five different schools.
Wow.
So fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth. And so when you move five schools in 5 years, there are some skills you learn. I know how to walk in a room and not know anyone. Because
yeah. Yes.
I did that a lot when I was young, right?
Wow.
You know, you figure out how to make friends kind of easily. You figure out how to size up a group of people pretty easily. I mean, so some of those things, yeah, I think I didn't mean to learn that. That was just my existence and my experience. And I suppose now probably it has served me quite well. I rarely meet a stranger. I always talk to, you know, people in malls and airports and airplanes mm-hmm. and, you know, because that's what I've had to do is, you know, in my younger years, I had to learn how to make friends kind of easily.
It's funny, you know, people always ask me, because I've been at Second City for 30 years, you know, about, you know, do people get into comedy because they're damaged? And my standard phrase in the past, because it's a laugh line, is I'd say no one got into comedy because they're well adjusted. But thank you. While that is true, I think that is true for humanity. I don't think most of us are really well adjusted. And so, you know, when you look at the experience that you had, which is so formative, all those different schools at that time, there's a couple different ways that can play, right? That can make you inert or I'm not suggesting it was traumatic, but there is this term post-traumatic growth. There's this idea of also of like, you know what, I'm going to take this difficult thing and I'm going to use it to make myself a little bit better. And when you can sort of move through the world, and I think this is the stuff that, you know, I haven't read her book yet, the one that she wrote with Adam Grant. Why am I blanking on
Sheryl Sandberg?
Yeah. You know, but I know from conversations with Adam, because he's a friend, that, you know, this is a big part of that, of finding, you know, this tragic situation that she went through and a way to make it through and become maybe a little bit stronger.
Well, absolutely. I think actually the gift of childhood, by the way, is I wasn't old enough to know that everyone sure. else didn't go to five schools in 5 years. Yeah, you don't understand context.
Right.
And so I think you just do it. And I think that's what's wonderful about the human spirit. For the most part, I think we're survivors, right? We're mm-hmm. thrivers and fighters for, you know, millennia before us, you know, hunt and gather and survive and sure. prosper. And, you know, so whatever my certain struggle was, I adapted. I mean, that's what the species does, right? We mm-hmm. adapt and we survive. And I reflect on it now as an adult and go, wow, those were actually really useful skills to learn at an early age. Mm. I do think the interesting thing about what you were saying, and Sheryl is a dear friend, and certainly, gosh, the unthinkable, right?
Right.
The unthinkable, and how she has, so back to the beginnings of our conversation, so openly and transparently
yes.
shared
yes.
her grief, mm-hmm. her journey, the absolute, you can't even say disruption. I mean, just almost tearing apart of her life, and then the rebuilding, and then how she has grasped it and moved on and made a new life for herself and her children. And to be so honest about that now, again, back to that sort of dialogue of what we expect of people and then how we respect that. And then further, if you will, and I don't necessarily like making this bridge from something so incredible to a brand situation, but I think, you know, back to the discussion on United,
mm-hmm.
the what if you acted in the same way? What if you took
sure.
from that crisis and made that crisis transformative? I think that's the way that you have to build the path forward. You can't just seek to brush it away and aside. You've got to make that a transforming moment. And that was one thing I learned at Coke. You know, never waste a crisis, right?
Right.
Coke, the people who bought you New Coke in the early 80s figured out how to take something that was an absolute crisis for the company, no question, and catapult their business forward off that. That is a distinct skill and learning that I think all of us could study, both personally and professionally.
Well, that's it, right? So it is connected. The brand stuff's connected definitely to the personal. We were talking to Brené Brown last week, and the whole idea of, you know, it's very hard to be vulnerable, and there is a lot of shame associated with it. But you look at how, again, you know, what a brand is an inanimate, it's a, you know, an idea, you know, at the core of all of this are people, and people buy your products, and people respond to authenticity, which includes a lot of blemishes. probably more blemishes than the sort of clear skin of you know, like a supermodel. They we're very forgiving, I think, as a people, and we kind of love the second or third act when someone makes it through adversity. But you know, man, it just feels like corporate culture still doesn't seem to be catching on to that. So.
Yes, well, I'm hopeful that it will. And yep. I think that there are some, you know, cases and instances where you see companies doing it very well. You know, I think about Airbnb, who's been through some, you know, a couple of struggles see some the local law challenge in California, and they kind of got called out on how they were marketing, and they very quickly apologized, accepted blame, committed to change, and it was done. You know, it's not... Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be something that blows up if you manage it and handle it in a very authentic and committed way.
Yep. We're running out of time, and I'm going to ask you for your own yes and story, which is something we ask of almost all our guests on the show. But I do want to ask you and talk to you about the McDonald's account. Is that okay?
Of course.
All right. So you won a big piece of business when DDB landed the McDonald's account, and I want to talk to you about the process of going after that account and how it relates to your views on leadership, because you talk about this constraint of time making the whole thing clearer, these time restraints. And there's a theater artist in Chicago, my friend Michael Patrick Thornton, who coined this term that I love, which is exquisite pressure, that sometimes you need these constraints to get the best work sure. out of you. Is that what happened with you guys?
I think, well, there's so many things. I mean, I would acknowledge that statement very much. So, I mean, I'm trying to think who said the quote. I'm going to butcher it. It was someone like Da Vinci or someone that prolific who said, creativity is driven by constraint, right? Yeah. If we have limitless resource and time, you know, whatever you want to say, time, money, options, our creativity tends to be limited. It's from the constraint. It's from the you've got to find a solution inside this box, and whatever the box constraint is, that our greatest creativity comes. That's always, always true. Mm-hmm. So many of the brilliant creative campaigns and ideas you see out in the marketplace, so many of them are not multi-million dollars. I mean, look at the best one right now is the Fearless Girl statue down
totally.
On Wall Street.
Yep.
Right? A $50,000 statue. That's it. Right? I mean, you think about the hundreds of millions of dollars that advertisers spend on brands and campaigns, relatively speaking, a $50,000 statue seems, you know, like a really amazing, you know, execution for the amount of engagement it got. But so, yes, on McDonald's, it was a number of things. I mean, not the least of which is the tireless energy and effort of thousands of people who worked on that. So it's always so hard for me as one individual to speak about it because it was a thousand fingerprints, honestly, from so many people. But truly from a perspective of a sense of pride of people just really working so hard, giving everything they had, all of their capabilities, and we were able to prevail in this instance. There are instances you don't, and that's part of our industry. But in that one, I think it was a combination of great innovative thinking, lots of true creativity within the restraints of there was constraints on time. It was a very quick review, and then you know I think just stick with itness, if that's a word. And we just really put both shoulders into it. There were, through the course of the review, there were 19 engagements we had with the client, which is, you know, a lot. And we kept showing up. And I think we kept showing up in a way that was innovative and powerful and really focused on their business. And now, you know, listen, that part's behind us. So now we're really focused on making it a reality and driving their business. And that's the most important thing we can do is put our heads down and work hard. So that's what we're doing.
This is the whole concept of the podcast is, you know, central idea in improvisation is that to get anywhere, you can't say no. And you can't just say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And we find with most of our guests that at some point in their life, they came across a situation where they would normally say no. But instead, they said yes and it proved to be kind of crucial. And I'm wondering if you have one of those stories for us from your experience.
Well, yes. I mean, I think I have actually plenty, to be honest with you, which I think is a perhaps back to that sort of the water just being right below my nose. I mean, I really personally try to put myself in those situations, but probably the most pronounced one was actually when I went to Coke. I was at AT&T at the time, and my husband and I at the time had decided we were not going to move again. We'd moved several times from my job, and the family was very situated. We had a very, very young child, sort of a year old, of our third one at the time. And so casually over dinner, I just mentioned, because a headhunter called me about this job for Coke, and I just sort of dropped it at dinner, and I said, you know, this recruiter called me about this marketing job at Coke today, but I'm definitely not going to call him back because, you know, that's not really in line with our plan, and that would just sort of mess everything up, and everything's going really copacetic here. And I just sort of talked until I ran out of breath, and my husband sort of looked at me and sort of cocked his head sideways, and he said, let me get this straight. And I mean, at the time, I think I'd been, you know, 18 years. He's like, you've had 18 years building your career in advertising and marketing. Perhaps one of the most iconic, if not the most iconic brand, just called you about a global job to work in marketing at Coke, but you're definitely not going to call them back. You know, and that was the moment. And I kind of looked at him and he's like, you know, screw the plan. Call them back, Wendy. And so I did. And of course, the rest is history. And that was, I mean, you know, working at Coke as a marketer is essentially about getting a higher degree in marketing. I mean, the world's best marketers are there. So for me, a shaping and transformative experience as a marketer. So I'm awfully glad I did.
Yep. Hey, Wendy, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
All right. Thanks, Kelly. It was fun.
Working in a coal mine.